Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, and that is Mr. Dave Green, the author of the Substack Fiddler's Green, otherwise known as the Distributionist. So, Dave, hello.
It's good. Yeah, it's an unpronounceable YouTube name, the Distributist, but I didn't actually intend it to be a YouTube channel, and I never thought it would get this big, so I got stuck with that, but now I'm just going by my pseudonym, Dave Green.
Excellent, yeah. Did I just pronounce it wrong in the excitement of the moment?
It's a philosophy developed by G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc called Distributism. And it was one of these early third way philosophies from the early 20th century. So, you know, it really isn't pertain to anything I ordinarily write about.
I'm glad you told me that, because I'm writing this book at the moment about Jonathan Bowden.
Oh, okay.
And I mentioned that philosophy in the book.
So excellent.
I'm coming to the conclusion I must have spelt it wrong in the book. Hang on, distributionism. That's how I've spelt it. So that's wrong. It's there was an attempt to ground this thinking in something British, specifically G.K. Chesterton's philosophy of distributionism.
So yeah, I spelled that. It's definitely distributism. Usually, I don't know. I mean, again, these philosophies were all kind of circulating the sphere in the early 20th century, along with other ideas. You know, other third positionist ideas. So there's a lot of cross pollination.
And the idea is that you should have the widest possible distribution of productive property, idealization of small scale craftsmanship, and the view that the nation is mankind's natural unit.
The family is mankind's natural unit. That was the idea, and that nations were kind of extensions of the family unit. You know, I think that distributists tried to distinguish themselves from nationalists in that way, in that the sort of large-scale industrial nation-state that was sort of in vogue was dealt with a certain amount of skepticism. I don't want to say total skepticism, because there were a lot of distributists who crossed over into fascism and socialism, which were sort of the other alternative viewpoints. But the skepticism towards sort of the large industrial nation state as conceived was one of the core tenets. And so it was a little bit vague, because there are so many people who kind of participate and try to do a bent on it that it's hard to characterize the philosophy in its totality. But you can characterize it historically.
Yeah, in what I was writing, it said that there's basically been attempts. We're going to talk about the dissident right and so forth in this in this discussion. And it said that in what I was reading that there was a sort of feeling that the new right, as it were, as introduced into British thinking by Grace and Adam de Benoit and people like that, was too foreign, was too continental.
Yeah.
And so it said in what I was reading that Michael Walker and people like this then tried to promote the idea that, oh, actually, no, there is a British underpinning to these kinds of ideas. And one of these examples is as you say, G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc and distributism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think that with a lot of these right-wing ideas, and this sort of pertains to my article to link back to what you wanted to talk about, we really are trying to come to peace with the fact that the ancient way of conceptualizing politics was much more accurate, like everything said and done, than the modern one that became popular in the 19th century and then sort of fully autonomous in the 20th century. And so what people try to do is they try to integrate choice elements of these older ways of approaching politics into modern politics. And I think that this is very effective. In many ways, you could see all postmodern politics is more or less a project that's like that. But I, and this sort of pertains to my article, I really think the only people who are clear about what we are doing are thinkers on the right. The left does this, but they do this under sort of a cloak of pretension. And so you'll see them try to, you know, toy with things like Black nationalism, or communitarianism, or certain elements of deep environmentalism, but they'll always try to do so under the veneer of this enlightenment, equality, fraternity, you know, whatever, equality and freedom. And those ideas don't really fit very well together, especially in the modern world, I find.
Why is that?
So, I mean, okay, we could go over a few of these things here. So, I mean, like, you know, I go over a bunch of points in my article that you mentioned about where we really have differences with modernity and modern concepts of government. So, I mean, like, you know, take, for instance, equality, right? I mean, you've gone over this. This is sort of a core tenet of 19th century socialist thinking and then 20th century liberal egalitarian thinking. This is borrowed from a Christian principle of sort of equal dignity, let's say, right? Because equality in the Christian conception is neither equality of physical attribute, nor is it necessarily an equality of placement in the afterlife. You know, Jesus says there will be the first is last. He implies an ordering even in heaven of peoples. So, you know, Christians didn't believe necessarily in equality in the afterlife or equality before the throne of God. They certainly didn't believe in equality of physical form. But then when it gets to...
Well, even the Marxists, from each according to his ability, it implies inherently different abilities.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if you go to early... I believe Marx contradicts himself, and I think he was a brilliant thinker, but I don't think he was particularly consistent. And so whenever you develop a Marxist theory as a coherent theory, you necessarily have to pick and choose certain things that, like, a certain... Which period of Marx are we talking about, right? And, you know, early on, at least, Marx is very, very aware that equality is impossible. Even economic equality is impossible. I can't remember where he talks about this. Maybe it's apocryphal, but he talks about, at least in this apocryphal source, he talks about how, let's say that there's two laborers that do different amounts of work. Do you pay them the same or do you pay them differently? Well, if you pay them the same, then their equality of economic, like, resources, but there is an inequality of their time, right? But if you pay them differently in proportion to their time, then one person's accumulated more resources, and therefore equalities naturally begin to develop economically, like, and that has a carry-on effect. And so you know, leftism, modern leftism, is obsessed with egalitarianism, especially egalitarianism in between groups. So how did this go from being sort of a spiritual predilection of equal dignity in the Christian conception to being sort of a goal of 19th century socialism economically to being kind of this writ of faith that any attempt to recognize inequalities or differences in a moral framework is not only unpreferable, it's just a total anathema to progressive thought. And so now we have entire societies organized around asserting and creating artificial inequalities to the detriment of their entire societies. Look at our immigration policy, look at racial preference systems, look at any number, look how we manage our entire educational system.
That's a very good point that you made about this idea of equality being the same as an assertion of dignity. I mean, yeah. I think that's what they mean. So if you say that there is that different social class, different individuals are unequal in the sense of their abilities, people can cope with that. But if you say that different races or ethnic groups or whatever are unequal, they find that more difficult, mm-hmm. because that's almost like saying that one group is less dignified than another group.
Well, exactly, and that is because I think that earlier peoples, like ancient peoples, like even the Greeks knew that different peoples had different properties on average. That is the default belief of humanity. Like, we didn't need to look at DNA and who knows, I mean, you know this better than I do, to what extent that this is evidence. Like, we didn't need to look at DNA to see that different groups have statistically different properties. Everyone saw and knew this before the 19th century. But, you know, then when we sort of lost our, what we asserted, though, is despite the fact that different peoples behave differently, both at the group level and individually, they still had this equal thing called dignity. And you know, I still firmly believe that, you know, from my Christian faith and just personally. But then in the 19th century, as we became sort of increasingly materialistic, the quality of dignity had to have some physical manifestation to evidence it, which became this assertion that people have equal dignity because they have equal cognitive capacities. And that's just, I mean, no one ever said that, but that was like the assumption that crept in because of our inability to grapple with, you know, with the fact that this is essentially a religious principle we're pursuing.
But also not... the very notion of dignity is, what is dignity? How do we determine?
Yeah, exactly.
Jordan Peterson about how are we defining dignity? How are we going to define dignity? I mean, you know, dignity is, I'm guessing, something like the accordance of honor and respect.
Yeah, exactly. It's the accordance of respect. That's exactly right.
That puts me in mind of the Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, the Mikado, I think, where if everybody's somebody... Is it the Mikado? If everybody's somebody, then no one's anybody. If everyone has equal dignity and respect, then nobody does. I mean, then, you know, let's have Lord Chancellor.
Is it?
Well, yeah, I think so.
If you say,
what does it mean to be important? Then if you say, well, we're all important.
Yeah.
Well, then no one's important.
Now, important is zero sum, but dignity is hypothetically not, right? Like, dignity is the accordance of respect as, you know, the you see this in things like Shakespeare.
What are you respecting?
You're respecting, I mean, there's no way to express it without expressing it inside religious language. And I guess this is sort of one of my problems with materialism. Like, you're expressing the recognition that there are a soul in a greater order of things and that they are properly fulfilling that role. So, for instance, you know, like the whole concept of noblesse oblige is that depends on this example, this idea of equal dignity, where the noble is sort of, I mean, he's not taking orders from the peasant, certainly. That's ridiculous. But they're according to the peasant this sort of equality of spirit, this, you know, this poetic quality, like, you know, I am not a better man than you because I occupy a higher station, or because I am stronger, or because I am, you know, I am more important, as you put it. You know, this is sort of, I mean, Kant tried to do this a little bit, right? This idea that, you know, the morality of the choice, and I'm probably butchering Kant here, right? But the morality of the choice is totally individuated to the challenges one has to overcome inside themselves. So, you know, for instance, it might be easier for me to lift, you know, 200 pounds. I don't know how many kilograms that is. But I guess it was easy for me to do that when I was in my 20s, right? But for somebody who is, for someone who's naturally weaker, 200 pounds, getting there would be like this impossible task, right? Like, it would be very, very difficult to bench that amount of weight. And so the virtue that would be required to reach that level would be higher. So the idea of dignity is that people are acting morally within their own, within the confines of their ability and their station in life.
Right. That, it's almost like Hinduism then. It's like you're being a good Shudra. So you're a Shudra, and you're acting as a good Shudra, and thus you have the dignity of being a good Shudra.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily attach this to specifically the Indian caste system, because there's all sorts of notions of reincarnation and stations sort of being predetermined.
Yeah, if you're a good Shudra, then you can reincarnate as a Vaishya.
Yeah. Well, I think that's not exactly how the Christian, I mean, that the superimposition of Hinduism onto this thing kind of disrupts the poetic Christian understanding of this. Whereas, you know, the poor man Lazarus is actually a great man in the kingdom of heaven. And like, this is an ultimate state, like above the corrupt rich man. And so this is like an ultimate state. This isn't some kind of like, giant pinball game where, you know, you're playing a giant game of musical chairs, and then mixing my metaphors there. But, you know, I think that an element of this is the explanation of what we know as dignity. It is this idea that there is a spiritual virtue that attends to those who practice virtue regardless of their state, regardless of their abilities, in sort of proportion or in respect to whatever disadvantages they might have in terms of ability and in respect to whatever they might have also as part of economic disadvantages. And so this is sort of, I don't know how to express this without sort of superimposing either a Christian or potentially a Hindu framework. In a materialist worldview, this feels like self-serving explanations of how inequality works, or to justify the inequality.
It occurs to me that one of the problems with, and you kind of allude to this in your analysis, one of the problems with a lot of these modernist ideas is there is no spiritual element to them.
That's the problem. The problem is not that there are no, all human beliefs have spiritual elements to them. Like, human rights is a spiritual concept. Like, can I see human rights? Can I find it in a test tube? Like, obviously not, right? But like, this is a spiritual, like, you look at like the LGBTQ movement, like these are obviously like religious movements, right? Or like any of the woke stuff, right? These are obviously religious movements. The problem is they don't realize they're religious, and the intellectuals in charge of them don't understand what they're actually doing. They think that they're talking about like a sociological model of the universe, aka it's a defunct sociological model. But they're teaching like this sociological model to their students, which is, again, the total bunk. But the students are absorbing this so-called sociological model as like a religious framework for the universe. So there's a total disconnect between what thinkers say they're doing and what they're actually doing. And that I see as being the source of a lot of the modern problems.
So do you think, I mean, one of the things that I've written about in some of my stuff is this idea, it's my colleague Ollie's idea, he summarized it quite well, is that if according to their theology, we're basically all gods.
Yeah.
We are divine chinks of light that define who we are. But then there are also these evil chinks of light that tell us we can't do that. And they must be combated.
Yeah, I mean, this is... And I really don't want to tempt the James Lindsay comparison, but this is actually something that we could talk about historically in the Spenglerian cycle. I don't know why this is, but this kind of idea, like we're all kind of God, but there's an evil demiurge that's cloaking like the true immanence of our own divinity from us. And that own cloaking must be punctured through. This is absolutely a quality of progressivism. This is why progressivism sociologically gets compared to Gnosticism. But the problem is, like, I don't think that there is actually a genealogy that leads from Gnosticism to modern progressivism, like James Lindsay seems to think, if you've ever talked to him. Rather, I think this is more like what Spengler talks about. For some reason, at the late stage of these civilizational cycles, this idea about like us all being like gods unto ourselves that are kind of liberated from all morality other than to stifle the potential of another one of these brave divine beings, and then that there's a demiurge over us. This is a spirituality that just seems to be very, very common, or just like it almost seems sociologically necessary in these types of declining degenerate civilizations like the one we occupy.
Yes, I think that would make sense, because as I would see it from an evolutionary perspective, and you talk, I think was it you that mentioned this, you said that secularism doesn't lead to wealth leads to secularism, or something along those lines.
Yeah, this is the argument with Hanania, right? So the thing that earned me the Hanania's block button, it's kind of silly when you think about it. He's like, oh, look, all of the wealthiest countries are secular or are more secular than the poorer ones. Like, there's this obvious relationship both historically and both longitudinally and laterally, like across countries and also longitudinally into the past, right? So look, this is obviously shows that secularism creates wealth. And that's just I mean, that's fine. You can see that relationship, but it's obviously the causation arrows go the opposite way, right? Like, obviously, like, communism proves this. Like, communism proves this because communism tries to superimpose secularism on poor, primitive people, and it does not make them more rich, right? So, obviously, what happens is when people get rich, they get less religious. That's obviously the causation.
And there's so many studies that indicate that, that if you prime people with wealth and materialism, they have a low, their instincts don't hit in, and they are less religious, and they have less of a desire to have children and things like this. Whereas if you prime people with mortality salience, which is our evolutionary match, you know, sort of 40% child about mortality until 1800, then they become religious and they become pronatal.
And so what does every jailed millionaire discover in prison when he's like exposed for fraud and like Enron? Like, they all discover God, right? Like, they all discover God in prison, right? or if people go bankrupt, they become more religious. And when they win the lottery, they become less religious, right? This is a very obvious, and I recognize this in myself. Like, I find myself growing less religious as things get better for me. But like, I try to fight that, you know, but this is just one of those like eternal human anthropological, like Jesus knew about this. Aristotle knew about this. Like, everyone knew about this until the modern time. And then we have to convince ourselves that we've come up with a formula for wealth. Right. So I'm sorry, I interrupted you there, but yeah.
Well, no, the point that I was making about that is that they,
when I can't find enough base knowledge to feed the inner workings of my mind, and I go onto Audible, and all I can find is warmed-up diarrhea by people like Adam Rutherford and Angela Saini, I sometimes don't know what to do. But that's why I use Legion.com. Legion.com gets the most based books, summarizes them into key salient points, and reads them to you in 25 enthralling minutes, whether it's my own books or whether it's Who We Are and How We Got Here by David Reich, a fascinating book which allows us to understand in much more depth the evolution of man using archaeogenetics, taking old skeletons, analyzing the different alleles, and telling you exactly how we evolved. Whatever based book it is, Legion.com is the one for me.
Yeah, he's got that the wrong way round, and the problem is that we are in this evolutionary mismatch. We are not in the environment that we're supposed to be in, and that is particularly the case in late stage civilization, once we become rich, and so therefore you would expect in late stage civilization some sort of aberrant weird theology to manifest. And like Gnosticism, and like what we have now, so there doesn't perhaps have to be, as you say, a genealogical link between the Gnosticism of the early church, or indeed the revived Gnosticism of the Middle Ages. Although interestingly, that was a warm period. But anyway, and what we have now, but you can see how similar kind, for some reason, similar kinds of thinking, I don't quite know why, but similar kinds of thinking might develop, because we're not in what is basically our match because we're rich.
So does the warm period begin in the late Roman Empire and then persist into the Renaissance?
You have a number of warm periods. No, you have a number of different warm periods. So you have the idea is that with a warm period, life would be easier, there would be less death, people would become, what's going on here?
Oh, we broke up a little bit, but are you back?
Okay, I'm back. Yeah. There would be less death. There would be less mortality salience, and so people would become a bit sort of decadent or whatever, right? And so you have the warm period in the late Roman Empire, and then you have a massive cold period. And then you have a which collapses the Roman Empire, and then you have a medieval warm period, and then you have the Black Death, which is a sign of very cold period,
and that's interesting because in the late medieval period, where that warm period was, there was a Gnostic cult called the Cathars.
Exactly, there were a number of And they were far, people in that period, people were far more tolerant of witches or Muslims or homosexuals or whatever, yeah. or different. And then it gets cold, there's strong selection for religiousness, there's death, mortality salience, and people become more conservative and more more religious. But that's, I don't know, it's just a theory. But we're moving away there from what do you think, I mean, what you seem to be implying is that the world, the sort of traditionalist way of understanding the world, this idea that the way that you structure things should be the response to like the Mysterium Tremendum et Fascinans or something of René Guénon and people like that, makes more sense than the left-wing way of doing things. I mean, what would you say to people that say that traditionalism is basically just postmodernism for right-wing people? It's got similarly pretentious writing, it's got similarly impenetrable writing, it's got similarly, it's got dogmas, it's... What would you say?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I found the most instructive of the thinkers on the right wing to be Joseph de Maistre. Or if you reread Isaiah Berlin's Fox and the Hedgehog essay, which is, Isaiah Berlin was very skeptical, but I think he does a good rendition of him. He was this French early 19th century reactionary. And Isaiah Berlin's skeptical, but Isaiah Berlin's so honest that you can't help see him shine through his review of his work. And Joseph de Maistre believed that foundationally everything is kind of hidden behind these principles that are too complicated or too abstract or too metaphysical for us to question, because human questioning could disassemble anything. Like anything put under the microscope of deconstruction is going to be desacralized and become weak. So eventually all religion either has to hide itself, either has to declare itself to be purely spiritual, or it has to hide itself behind some kind of Byzantine impenetrable process. Like you understand this if you talk to modern progressive academics, like they end up with all of these like moral platitudes that seem like they make no sense, but they all have like these insanely complicated explanations. Like Rawlsianism is a good example. They all have like these insanely complicated explanations about why they're valid and don't involve touching like, you know, unstated assumptions, but they're like, you can fill up books with the explanations and they're all kind of facile. They all kind of fall apart once you just blow on them a little bit. And I come to believe the large amount of what these academics are doing is they're trying to sort of hide the machine of God behind laborious language, that they're creating kind of a modern mystery cult. And they don't want to declare themselves as pure spirits. They want to say, oh, well, there's this machinery of logic that necessitates my worldview, that necessitates the Rawlsian liberal egalitarianism. But, you know, you have to read these 3,000 volumes of Byzantine prose that doesn't even make sense. And, you know, because it's hidden behind this instead of a veil hiding the Delphic oracle, now it is this like impenetrable academic prose that's hiding the machinations of why we all have to be Rawlsian egalitarians. But like, you know, you read this stuff and it never makes sense and you question it and people are like, oh, you have to read the next volume. You have to read the next volume. You have to read the next volume. So exactly. But ultimately it's my belief that what's going on is just simply a religious, like they believe egalitarianism is a declared revealed moral imperative by God. That like that's what they believe. And this whole academic, like, oh, behind the
one could argue that the very idea that certain truths could be known a priori,
yeah,
which is what a lot of these continental philosophers aver, that there are certain truths that can be known just by the nature of contemplation.
Yeah, exactly.
If you contemplate hard enough, you will realize it. I haven't realized it. Well, contemplate some more.
Yeah.
it's an implicitly religious idea that these are just dogmas. These are just foundational dogmas that you believe. But I suppose you have a very similar thing with the traditionalist writers as well. The people like Julius Evola or whatever. It's this impenetrable, difficult prose, and it is.
Yeah. Um, well, I kind of Yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with Lobola. Sometimes I like him, sometimes I hate him.
And all he's really saying is that you should hold to the same beliefs that most people held to circa 1750.
Yeah.
That's basically what he's saying.
I guess, you know, there's a hint of truth in the whole a priori thing, in that the core beliefs, and I'm again borrowing this from De Maistre, like the core beliefs that mankind starts with are kind of received, not as, you know, like they say a priori, as like a prior to doing thought, like you just kind of arrive at this conclusion because you want to think, sort of like the Descartesian cognito ergo sum or whatever, right? But that instinct is correct, in that I think human beings just kind of receive a lot of their beliefs just implicitly by them thinking like humans. But I think that the right wing has a better understanding of it, because it understands that these beliefs are kind of emergent from our biologies, or, you know, if you're like me and you believe in a spirit, emergent from like intrinsic properties of what we are, either spiritually or materially. They're not like some kind of necessary thing that falls out of like the piano axioms and like logic itself. And if we were to construct like a Turing machine, or an AI based on the Turing machine, to just process these phrases, they would not rederive them, and they do not when we try this. These moral ideas have to be inserted into these machines. They don't just discover them from the fact that they're doing calculations. Well,
they're
in the abstract.
They're effectively instincts. I
mean, yeah.
And that's quite interesting, because what you would expect in late stage civilization, when you have a collapse in harsh Darwinian conditions, and basically under harsh conditions, only about 10% of us should even be alive.
Harsh.
is this massive buildup of mutation, which would be associated with mutation in the brain, because the brain's 84% of the genome. And so then you'd have all of these people that would have ideas that deviated from what we were evolved towards, i.e. to be group-oriented and religious and, value the sacred and all this. Mm. And so you just get deviations from those ideas, mainly in the direction of being individualistic, i.e. being left-wing and concerned with equality and things like that.
Yeah.
Because we're under harsh Darwinian conditions, groups are fighting each other, we have to be basically conservative, right-wing. If you get a weaker conditions, you're going to get all this. So you could argue one of the problems is that the left and the right essentially have different inbuilt instincts, either because they have different bad mutations, or because the right are more likely to have, are more likely to be the remnant normal genetic healthy population.
This is interesting, right? Because like, if you were, I think I would have agreed with you in the 90s. Like, I wasn't actually thinking this way in the 90s, but like observing how what leftists were in the 90s, this was, you know, far leftists were a small subset of the population. And they had very particular opinions, which they chose. Like these were not things they got from their teachers. They kind of found their way into these places, and they had a few areas that they thrived in, but now like huge swaths of our society just adopt these ideas.
Yeah, they've taken over. So what
They're coming from power. They're not coming from biology at this age. Like they're receiving.
Yeah, but it could start with biology, and then you could get like a tipping point where you would tip over from being a right-wing society to being a left-wing society. And then intelligent people would take up those ideas and competitively signal with them.
Yeah.
And then it spread through society such that it was, as I've looked at in a book I did called Woke Eugenics, such that everybody that's not really, really genetically healthy will be sucked into this death cult. So it's kind of like society culling itself so that it can be healthy again, like a farmer would do.
Yeah, well, I actually have a question for you, not to invert this interview. But the most salient demographic emergence in the last 2 years that we've been able to observe statistically is the political divergence between men and women. It's radical. It is radical. And if you control, I actually haven't looked into this, but I bet you that you'd find this. If you took the data on the charts that you usually see about how men and women's opinions like divert like this, you would see that as you adjusted for younger ages, the diversion would be even more radical. So we are just at the beginning of this great gender diversion. And this will absolutely characterize the next 10 years of polls. It's more than the Trump election. It's easy. Like, I think the thesis about a progressive self-calling is, you know, I like it. It's optimistic. I want things to resolve that way. But the more interesting, not the more interesting, but the bigger problem to that, and what I kind of want to hear your take on, is how does that work when it seems, at least in things, unless things radically change, almost like an enormous number of women are just going to the left, and then the mainstay of men are going to the right. You see this more in a more advanced state in North Korea.
In North Korea?
South Korea. But in South Korea, the gender divergence is more radical.
I didn't know that. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, you should talk to Carl Benjamin about this. He's done recently, he and the Lotus Eaters have done this. In South Korea, there's this movement called the Four Bs, the Four No's. It's like no. Bs is no, but it's like no. It's no children, no marriage, no, you know, people paraphrase to be like, no booty, no betrothal, no babies, and no BFFs, right? Or no boyfriends.
I suspect the thing is with those people is that they are, with the Northeast Asians, they are highly K-strategic, they're highly environmentally sensitive. Mm. So you would expect, have you got a little baby in the background there?
Yeah, I do. Sorry.
So you would expect modern society to send them mad in a way that it would do to a lesser extent with more instinctive, less people like us Europeans. And so they're not having enough. I mean, like the fertility rate in Korea, in South Korea, is about 0.8. I mean, they're just dying. They're just not having.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't know to what extent that this divergence in political opinions between men and women is helping that or driving it. Or if they're, it's actually a good question. I actually think that this sort of South Korean gender divergence and among political opinions, they might have caught this from the West. It's like they say, like that's what Yarvin used to say about this. He's like, you know, the America is the origin of all of these bad left-wing ideas, but America has more immunity to it because we have like sort of a built-up resilience to it. So it's like America had a built-up resilience to feminism, and then we went over there and we gave them feminism to Korea, and because Korea doesn't have the immunity, like feminism just runs wild and like, you know, it's cratering their birth rates and all this stuff. But I guess the question is, like, I think that the resolution of this gender divide is the first real, you know, my friend Black Horse talks about, I probably got this from you actually, because you've been talking about this for ages, but he talks about a genetic bottleneck that is happening right now. But the next really big bottleneck, as I say it, is going to be driven by this political divergence.
This is very interesting. I mean, by the way, if you got it from me, you know, I'm honored that you've heard me. But how do you see that? I mean, there's always been a, even if you go back to the, there was an Australian study for people born in 1920, men were more left-wing than women.
Yes.
Why? Because it was a right-wing society.
Yeah.
And that's what women do. Women are socially anxious, so they hyper-social conform. So it's a right-wing society. The women are going to be right-wing.
Yeah.
And the men are less socially anxious, and they're quite like, there's a degree to which perhaps they're quite like rebelling and things like that, and so they're more likely to be left wing. And then by the generation that was born in the 50s, by the time they started voting, which was in the 70s, that had flipped.
Yes,
because we had moved in Australia into a more, you know, proto woke, whatever you want to call it, society. The women are now more left wing than the men. So and we just, this has just gone in extremis, like the difference has become much more pronounced. But of course they can't split up completely because ultimately they want to have, what I wonder is two things. There is also evidence of polarization. So the increasing polarization. So there was a study by data by, I can't remember his name. Anyway, it found that...
Are you ready for the future of the West?